From the nation's capital, this is DC Public Safety. I'm your host, Leonard Sipes. Ladies and gentlemen, today the topic is religion in corrections. We have Ronald G. Turner, a GED and PhD, with us today. Ron is a frequent speaker in inmate religious rights. He led workshops on the topic at the 2011-2013 American Correctional Association's Annual Congress of Corrections. In May this year, he was a panelist on the National Institute of Corrections two-day training on religion in corrections. He led workshops sponsored by the National Institute of Corrections in Denver for the chief legal counsels and food service directors for prison systems across the country. He's also presented on the topic for the American Correctional Chaplains Association and Corrections Corporation of America. Ron, welcome to DC Public Safety.
Thanks, Len. I'm glad to be here.
Okay. First of all, before we get into the program is produced by the National Institute of Corrections, specifically Donna Ledbetter. We appreciate Donna's producing of the show. Ron, this religion in corrections has been called the hottest legal topic in corrections today. Is that correct?
There's no question about it. Since January 1st of this year, 238 lawsuits have been filed by inmates across the country in federal court asserting religious rights. That's almost one new lawsuit a day.
Now, that's amazing. I mean, you know, when I was in mainstream corrections for the state of Maryland for 14 years, it was, you know, people were astounded because they said, how do you spend your day? And is it talking about rehabilitation? Is it talking about security? Is it talking about reentry? And I said, no, well, the bulk of our day is spent in talking about or dealing with inmate medical care, because that was the hottest topic at the time 12 years ago. And now the hottest legal topic in corrections today is religion. That's astounding.
Well, there have been some legal developments in the last 15 years that account for that. We have a long history of freedom of religion in this country. The inmate population itself has exploded in the last 25 or 30 years. So there are a lot of reasons for it. Many people will hear that statistic and assume that 90% of those lawsuits are frivolous and ought to be thrown out. From my experience, that's not the case. A number of them are not frivolous.
In 2000, the U.S. Congress passed the Religious Land Use and Industrialized Persons Act. And in an article that you wrote recently, you summarize it three ways: that government must have a very good reason to limit an inmate's sincere religious practice, limits on religion must be imposed as gently as possible, and inmates may exercise their religion in ways not necessarily required by their faith. That's putting an big burden on correctional systems to interpret all this and to put it into play, correct?
Well, it is, and it's really tough to jump right into that, because when you start digging into that language, particularly if you're a prison or jail administrator, you want to throw your hands up and say, why would Congress do this to us? And we can get into those three aspects of the law. And I need to say, it's the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act. It's people who live in institutions, primarily prisons, jails, and some hospitals.
Mm-hmm. How important is religion in all of this? I interviewed an awful lot of chaplains, either from the Islamic faith, from the Protestant, Catholic, Jewish faith throughout my career. I found my discussions with chaplains to be some of the most interesting in all the broadcasts that I've done on the American criminal justice system. They all seem to assert that religion is extraordinarily important for reentry, for coming out, to maintain themselves while in correctional institutions. So religion is an integral part of the correctional system and always has been from its very roots. Is that correct?
Absolutely. And we have a number of studies that have been done. My own PhD dissertation dealt with the impact of religious faith and spirituality on inmates, particularly while they're incarcerated. And you're exactly right. It makes a difference while they're inside and then once they get out. And here again, there's a stereotype from the movies that, you know, inmates find religion in prison and then they lose it the day they walk out the gates. That happens to some folks, but it very often is a very real and sincere aspect of their lives, both in and out.
You've received your law degree and master's in theological studies, as well as a PhD in public administration from Tennessee State University. You have quite a background in terms of looking at it from a theological point of view, as well as a legal point of view. So it seems as if you're the top person to talk to in terms of what happens in correctional systems and the topic of religion.
Well, I appreciate it, let me just say that my law degree and my master's of theological studies were from Vanderbilt here in Nashville, and then I got the PhD at a later stage in life from Tennessee State. But I think one thing that I bring to this, first of all, I have a deep interest in it, an abiding interest in it. But I've been a college professor. I taught college for 7 years. I practiced law for over 20 years. I do have the theological training as well as the PhD, so I can talk to virtually everybody who's sitting around the table when this issue comes up, from correctional officers and wardens to chaplains to academics to commissioners, and it's a fascinating topic. I think I'm not surprised that it's as hot as it is, because the law that we're talking about, and we'll get into in a minute, has been on the books since 2000. The U.S. Supreme Court upheld its constitutionality in 2005. And inmates, from my experience all over the country, are familiar with the law, and they're becoming more and more willing to assert their rights under the law. I think a number of prison systems have been a little bit slow to catch up to it, but now they're being overrun by it. Particularly if you talk to any of the attorneys who work in the prison systems in all over the country, they're spending lots of time on these lawsuits.
Do want to remind all of our listeners that the program Religion and Corrections is available at the National Institute of Corrections website. It's www.nicic.gov, www.nicic.gov. If you simply search for religion, you'll find the seminar on religion and corrections on the National Institute of Corrections website. Ron, before we go on to the specifics of the program, I do want to return to the importance of religion. I mean, we at the Court Services and Offender Supervision Agency run a fairly substantial faith-based initiative, and we pretty much recognize that the faith community really is an integral, very important component in terms of people leaving the prison system, coming out in terms of being gathered and mentored to and helped by the faith-based community. They provide, in some cases, clothing, shelter, substance abuse, alcohol remediation. There's a lot of services the faith community offers, both inside and outside the prison system. So, again, the role of faith was an integral part of the American prison experience from the very beginning, as it is now. So let's talk a little bit more about that importance.
Well, there's no question that what you're saying is exactly right. I do want to specify or mention the fact that one of the purposes of this law, we call it RLUIPA, Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act, one of the purposes of it in being passed was to protect the religious rights of all institutionalized persons. And I probably will refer to them for the rest of the program as inmates, because we're talking primarily about prisons and jails.
Yes.
So it's inmates of minority religious faiths that are protected, as well as Christian and other inmates of larger faith groups. And the Congress was very specific about that when they passed the law.
But it's interesting, in terms of the role of chaplains, I was reading in an article that you created that the role of chaplains also has to be their insistence that everybody is taken care of. The role of prison chaplains is to see that religious rights of inmates of all faiths are protected. So in essence, that means that regardless of to your religious orientation, the chaplain is responsible for everybody within that institution to be sure that their religious faith is protected.
Well, that, unless that responsibility has been assigned by the warden to someone else, and usually it has not, it's usually the chaplain's responsibility. And from my experience as director of religious services here in Tennessee for 5 years, that's probably the most challenging aspect of being a prison chaplain, because certainly in Tennessee is a conservative state. We have 16 state-paid chaplains in 14 institutions, and they're all Christians. Some would call themselves evangelical Christians. And they make no bones about the fact that they were called to the ministry to save, to bring people to Jesus, which is fine outside the prison setting or even inside the prison setting. If the inmate comes to the chaplain and says, tell me about your faith, then the door's open. But if a chaplain of any faith, Christian, Jewish, Buddhist, you name it, starts imposing their faith on inmates, if they're getting their paycheck from the state, that's where you have some constitutional problems.
You know, back in Maryland, this will be fairly stereotypical. I remember these conversations. Do we allow certain people who use marijuana within religious ceremonies, do you allow marijuana to be used as part of this religious ceremony? There are some American Indians who fervently believe that smoke lodges or sweat lodges are an integral part of their religion. So the question was, do you allow sweat lodges? Do you allow the use of marijuana? It's far more complex than that, correct?
Well, it is, but with regard to that example, there's a pretty simple answer. The government has a compelling governmental interest, or in plain English, a really good reason to maintain safety and security in the prisons. That compelling governmental interest is a reason to impair an individual's religious practice. So even if a Native American has a sincere belief that they need marijuana or that they want marijuana in their religious practice, it won't be allowed because it's a risk to institutional safety and security.
Prison
safety and security will always trump religious faith.
Prisons are the very epitome of the word institutions. They run in a very bureaucratic round peg and round hole sort of approach. They are cities unto themselves. I've been in and out of prisons that have held over 2,000 inmates. These are very large structures. When you start talking about individualized diets, a vegetarian diet or a non-pork diet, or the allowance of a particular religious ceremony or the length of an inmate's hair. These are all things that the prison system has a hard time dealing with because they're used to walking in lockstep. Again, if it's not round peg and round hole, they really don't know what to do. When I was reading your article, you were advising chaplains to work closely with attorneys for the state prison systems and that, again, that the law says that institutions need to tread as lightly as possible on the religious rights of individualized inmates. So prison systems are now required, as long as they do not have an impact on the security of the institutions, to provide individuals with services that formerly were not provided.
Well, let me comment. I generally agree with what you've just said. Safety and security is a compelling governmental interest, and across the board it is. But we, the institution, have to be sincere when we say that there's a safety and security issue being raised by a particular thing. Let's use sweat lodges as an example.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose everyone listening knows, what a sweat lodge is. It's essentially a structure that's constructed usually by Native Americans, but there's some other groups that use them. They will have a fire outside, and they'll heat lots of rocks and bring the rocks inside and put water on them and create it. Essentially, it's like a sauna.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll stay in there. The inmates will stay in there. It's dark, up maybe 4 hours, and it's a spiritual experience for them. It's a genuine, sincere spiritual experience, but there are obviously some security aspects to it. It's dark, and many times they want to go in without any clothes on and so forth. As a result, some states allow sweat lodges, and some states don't allow sweat lodges. Even though RLUIPA is a federal law that was passed by Congress, it's in force in all 50 states. It applies to all prisons and jails and other institutions that receive federal funds, so there'd be 99% of them.
Mm-hmm.
The Supreme Court has never ruled on the question of sweat lodges. So what we have is appellate courts, what we call the circuit courts of appeals, are ruling different ways on sweat lodges. Some are saying it's a security risk, we can't allow it, and others are saying, well, there are ways we can modify or protect this security risk, and so we are going to allow it. Until the Supreme Court rules on that question, we're going to have a split between the circuits on that question. We have splits on a number of questions: prayer oil, length of hair, beards, diet, and that's one reason the job is so difficult right now of chaplains and prison officials enforcing the law, because there are provisions in the law that just haven't been clarified by the Supreme Court. But there's a case coming up later this year, and we can talk about that later, that might answer some of that.
Our topic today, ladies and gentlemen, is religion and corrections. Our guest is Ronald G. Turner, extraordinarily qualified. He has a law degree and his master's degree in theological studies, as well as a PhD from Tennessee State University. The program has been arranged and produced by the National Institute of Corrections, and there is a seminar, Religion and Corrections, on the National Institute of Corrections website, www.nicic.gov, www.nicic.gov. The email address for Ron is rturn787@gmail.com. rturn787@gmail.com. Ron, okay, so religion in corrections, you're dealing with prison populations, you're dealing with United States history, but you're dealing with the First Amendment that says the freedom of religion shall not be interfered with, shall not be abridged, I think.
Yeah, the exact language is Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. What we call the Establishment Clause and Free Exercise Clause, that basically say we will not have an official state-sponsored religion in this country. Likewise, the government's not going to come in and tell you how to worship. Now, that's a broad brush explanation of it. But if I could, I'd like to take just a second and get into the reasons that Congress passed this law in 2000.
Please.
In the first place.
Please.
Because it has created a lot of activity. In the 90s, in the early 1990s, Congress held some hearings to find out whether inmates in prisons and jails and folks who lived in other institutions were suffering religious abuse. Either they were not allowed to practice their own religion or another religion was being imposed on them. They found widespread abuse. They found what they called arbitrary and capricious abuse. In other words, there were times that things were denied to people when there was no reason for it. As a result, Congress passed a law in 1993 called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. Actually, it was much broader than just applying to prisons and hospitals. But the purpose of it was to expand the religious protection of virtually all citizens under the First Amendment. 4 years later, in 1997, the Supreme Court struck down that law and said it only applied to federal institutions. It did not apply to the states. Okay, so you essentially have a seesaw battle going back and forth here between Congress and the Supreme Court. Congress didn't like that. They are big supporters of freedom of religion, and so a new law was prepared called the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act. And Congress passed it in 2000. And I want to read a quote. The co-sponsors of that law, of RLUIPA in 2000, were Ted Kennedy and Orrin Hatch. They were co-sponsors in the Senate. Ted Kennedy said this about that law: "The pioneers who founded America came here to practice their faiths free from government interference, convinced of the need to assure for all Americans for all time the right to practice their religion unencumbered." Of course, Senator Kennedy was a Catholic, Democrat, liberal. Senator Hatch, conservative Republican Mormon from Utah, had this to say: "This law is important for the preservation of religious freedom of all American people, especially for those whose religious beliefs and practices differ from the majority." It's pretty clear from their statements they were wanting to protect the religious freedom of everybody. specifically minority religious groups. So they passed RLUIPA. Many people say, why in the world does it have such a crazy name? Well, in addition to dealing with institutionalized persons, the same law deals with religious discrimination in zoning matters. Mm-hmm. And in a nutshell, that comes up where a group of people buy a piece of property. They want to put up a church, but it's not zoned for a church or a temple or synagogue. They go to the local zoning authority or city council, and they submit their application. They've covered everything in the application that anybody else would cover. It's in good form and so forth, and the application is denied. It's pretty obvious that it's being denied because of religious discrimination. Well, Congress didn't like that either. So in this same law, they dealt with that type of thing. That's way beyond the scope of our program, but that's why it has such a funny name.
It says in plain English, the law says, before we substantially limit an inmate's religious exercise, we need a really good reason. The inmate must be sincere, but the request need not be required by the inmate's faith. So it's almost self-imposed by the inmate. You know, you could be a Roman Catholic, but not follow the tenets of Catholicism, and you could come up with your own interpretation of what they believe Catholicism is. Is that correct?
You're putting your finger on what I think is probably the toughest part of RLUIPA. Let me go back through these. This is what RLUIPA requires, and I want to talk about each component for just a second. And, of course, this is not the legalese. You can pull up the statute itself if you want to. But in plain English, the Congress is telling us that before we, and that's prisons and jails, substantially limit an inmate's religious exercise, we need a really good reason. So the first thing we might say is, well, we didn't substantially limit that inmate's exercise. This wasn't a substantial limit. The problem with that, or in using that defense, is that courts have interpreted the word substantial in a very different way than we might off the top of our head. Mm-hmm. Many times they will find a burden on an inmate's religious exercise to be substantial when we would kind of say, what? Are you kidding? So be careful if you're going to use lack of substantiality as a basis for denying a request. Secondly, it only applies to religious exercise. So we can say, well, this doesn't deal with religion. A Native American wants a feather. What's that have to do with religion? It has a lot to do with that Native American's religion. Mm-hmm. So here again, before you deny a request saying, hey, this isn't religious, you better get your lawyers involved and let them do some research and find out what the cases have said about what is religious. Another aspect of the law is it says, before we burden religious exercise, we need a compelling governmental interest, or in plain English, a really good reason. Safety and security is a classic example of a really good reason. Mm-hmm. Because, obviously the government has a compelling interest in maintaining safe and secure prisons. But just as the inmate must be sincere when they submit a request to us, and they do have to be sincere, we have to be sincere when we say, no, you can't have it. And the cases in the last few years have taken an interesting turn. Up until a few years ago, when a prison official, a warden, or a commissioner got on the witness stand, the judge would usually defer to their professional opinion. They'd say, you're the expert. You know how to run prisons. We don't. We'll defer to your judgment. Mm-hmm. Now, under RLUIPA, if the prison system denies a request based on safety and security, the courts are now saying, tell me why, warden or commissioner, why is it a safety and security issue? And what alternatives did you look at? Because not only did Congress tell us that we can't substantially limit an inmate's religious exercise, it says if we do limit an exercise, it has to be in the least restrictive way or the gentlest way. And I can give an example of that. Let's say you have this Native American inmate who wants a feather. I mentioned that before. And so we say, you can't have any feathers. No feathers whatsoever. There's a safety and security risk. Mm-hmm. And a feather can be because you can stab somebody with one, right?
Right.
Okay. So the most restrictive response we can give is, you can't have any feathers, no feathers. An absolute no is the most restrictive response. What would be less restrictive than that? What might we say?
Well, I don't know, because either you provide feathers or you don't provide feathers. Well, it seems to me to be fairly straightforward.
Okay. Well, we could say small feathers. The reason a feather is a risk is because it's big enough and sturdy enough to stab somebody. Let's say you can have feathers 6 inches or smaller. That's allowing some feathers. So, in other words, you're not saying absolutely no feathers, which is the most restrictive response. You're giving a less restrictive response by saying you can have small feathers.
I do find this fascinating. It says the law makes a world of difference from past years because the burden was on the inmate. Now it's on us. So, as you just said, the warden goes into court, and in the past, the court would defer to the warden. You're the expert. We're not. You tell us. Now the burden's on us to prove that we're providing for the constitutionality of that religious service.
As long as the inmate is sincere and it deals with religion, then the inmate gets it unless we can show a compelling reason why they shouldn't. And most of the time, that's going to be safety and security. That's 180 degrees different than the law before RLUIPA.
Yes, it is. It's
turned being a chaplain in prison on its head. A number of chaplains are retiring now because this isn't what they bargained for. It's not what they came in to do. Even those who are want to minister to inmates of all faiths find it much more difficult now than before. In the good old days, pre-RLUIPA, if an inmate came into your office, let's say a Buddhist came into your office before 2000 and asked for something, you'd pull your book off the shelf. You had a handbook of religious practices, and you'd turn the chapter on Buddhism, and you might, let's say he wants a meditation mat. You find in there meditation mat is approved. So you'd say, yeah, you can have it. Mm-hmm. If it wasn't on the list, he wouldn't get it.
But
you
again,
had to have... Go ahead.
It's relying. I go back to a point that I made before, and this is something from the 14 years when I was with the state of Maryland. These monolithic institutions, it is almost impossible to make these individualized decisions to protect the rights of individuals. It is a burden beyond all comprehension, because to run that institution and run it on a budget, and a fairly low budget, you've got to run things a certain way. And now it's saying that, no, the burden is upon us. The burden is upon the state to protect the constitutional religious rights of that inmates. And that may mean a whole host of individualized decisions to allow that inmate to practice his faith in a way that he thinks is valid, as long as he's, quote-unquote, sincere. That's a huge burden on correctional facilities, and I understand why chaplains are having a hard time with it.
There's no question about it, and it's one reason there's so many lawsuits pending right now. You mentioned meals. Religion and corrections is the hottest topic. Meals under religion in prison is the hottest part of that topic right now, particularly kosher meals and halal for Muslim inmates and so forth. And the court's going all over the place with regard to whether we're required to provide kosher meals. The big question is which inmates are entitled to have kosher meals. Most courts are saying under RLUIPA, you don't have to have been Jewish on the outside or go through a conversion process. And this applies not only to Jewish inmates, but inmates of any faith. If you can sincerely show a religious basis for requesting the meal, let's say kosher, you get it.
Fran, we only have a minute. We only have a minute left, and I don't want to leave this out. Holt versus Hobbs is an upcoming Supreme Court case.
Oh yes.
Give me a 45-second summation of Holt versus Hobbs.
Okay. Holt versus Hobbs is going to be heard by the Supreme Court later this year. It's the first Supreme Court case under RLUIPA since 2005. It's a beard case out of the Eighth Circuit where the prison said you can't have any beards for religious reasons. Well, the Court of Appeals agreed with the trial court based on the fact that 39 other states now allow beards under RLUIPA. My best prediction is the Supreme Court will allow beards. The question is whether the court will use this case as an opportunity to interpret some of these other ambiguous areas of RLUIPA. It bears watching, because the Supreme Court could answer a whole lot of these questions later this year if they want to.
And the complexity that's going to go along with it for correctional administrators, it's an amazing topic, Ron.
Well, it's fascinating.
And quickly.
tell folks that federal judges are interested in protecting constitutional rights. And running the prison, many times they will say that's the legislature's problem or the executive's problem.
All right, Ronald, I'm going to stop you there. Ladies and gentlemen, our guest today, it's been a fascinating conversation with Ronald G. Turner, Ph.D. and J.D. We're talking about religion within correctional institutions. Ladies and gentlemen, this is D.C. Public Safety. We appreciate your comments. We even appreciate your criticisms, and we want everybody to have themselves a very pleasant day.